This is The Reason Interview, where we go deep with the artists, entrepreneurs, and academics who are making the world more libertarian, or at least a little more interesting. I'm Eric Boehm, filling in for Nick Gillespie. This week, our guest is J.C. Bradbury, an economist at Kennesaw State University and one of America's foremost critics of taxpayer-funded sports stadiums. Bradbury is also the author of a forthcoming book about the false promises and fiscal realities of stadium subsidies, available later this year from Oxford University Press. In our conversation, we discuss how team owners manipulate politicians and the media to make stadium subsidies look like better economic deals than they really are, and why Bradbury believes America is on the cusp of another stadium building boom. I also ask him about next week's Super Bowl and the upcoming Olympic Games, which often come with huge price tags for local taxpayers. And now, The Reason Interview with J.C. Bradbury. J.C. Bradbury, thanks for talking to Reason.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Eric. Happy to talk with you.
So you are one of my favorite Twitter follows, which is, I think, how I first came across your work. But you are also the author of an upcoming book, This Time It'll Be Different, False Promises and Fiscal Reality of Publicly Funded Sports Stadiums. That'll be coming out later this year. I think in July is the publication date there. You've been an economist for a long time and published many studies on exactly that topic of the kind of foolishness of sports stadium subsidies. We will talk a lot about that today. Your day job is as a professor of economics at Kennesaw State University. Go Owls, which is right outside of Atlanta, Georgia. So let's start with the obvious question here, JC. Why do you hate sports?
Well, you know, people often ask me that. In fact, I love sports. And so as an economist, like most economists, I tend to take my obsession beyond typical topics. And so because I like sports, I've been studying sports for a long time. And my background is actually in public finance and public economics. And so public funding of stadiums is sort of a natural outgrowth of that. And so because I care about policy and I care about sports, I often focus on that. So, you know, I'm about speaking uncomfortable truths. And, you know, it would be great for me if I could come out and say sports are the best thing ever. And I could go and sit next to the owner at games and talk about how great the stadium is. But instead, you know, I have to wonder whether I'm going to get my ticket yanked when I walk through the door.
There is a need, I think, to separate out, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, a lot as we go here, to separate, the distinction between enjoying the games, enjoying the stadiums themselves, for that matter, and approving of the finances and the economics behind them.
Yeah, so there's a very big difference. And you know, what I really ask for is an honest discussion. And that's one of the reasons why I get so frustrated in these discussions is that people are looking for pretexts and excuses. And so that's one of the reasons why, you know, I titled my upcoming book, This One Will Be Different, because I hear that all the time. Anytime I say, well, stadiums generally don't work out, they go, oh, you don't understand, this one will be different. And it happens every single time. And so I think that's where we need to frame this discussion, is make sure we're being honest. And are there potential arguments for successful stadium investments? Yes, there are. And we've really investigated those quite thoroughly and debunked all of them. There's really no case to be made anymore. And so part of my reason for speaking out so much is to try and prevent communities from adopting what has been clearly determined as bad policies. And people who continue to support it, I want them to be called out for promoting something that is really supported either malevolently or with negligence that needs to be corrected.
I've seen some of that, you know, playing out firsthand here with a bit of news lately in the D.C. area has been that there's going to be a new stadium built, or at least there's been approval now for a new stadium to be built at the old RFK Stadium site in the city of Washington, D.C. The Commanders, the formerly known as the Redskins, have played out in Maryland for a number of years now, for decades. They're going to move back into the city. D.C. is paying something like $500 million for the infrastructure of this. It's a multi-billion dollar project. They're also putting in, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for parking garages, for utility upgrades, all sorts of stuff like that. So that's one of these situations where you see, like with all of these stories, you have obviously the fans of the team get very excited about this. You've got the pictures of what this new stadium could look like and how gorgeous it'll be and all of that. And that plays on these, the same passions that come out when people who are big Commanders fans go to the game and cheer for their team. And that those voices seem to speak a lot louder than you, or quite frankly, than the average resident of DC who maybe never goes to one of these games.
Yeah. So, you know, I make fun of the promotion of artist renderings that newspapers often share, or any media site often share. And I think it's because, So some of my perspective comes from this, from being the son of two journalists. My father worked in for a newspaper for most of his life. And I actually worked in a newsroom, and I see, you know, what it is that motivates newspapers. And I think it's an easy story to sell. You have some art that comes in. There's fireworks over the stadium. It's got a lot of lights. The hometown team is winning on the scoreboard. And you can write a story about how great it is. And everyone can pat themselves on the back and say, isn't this a nice feel-good story about the community? It's not about politics. It's not about some other scandal or crime. And so I think that everyone is just all too willing to accept it. And that's why these renderings are so important. And the interesting thing about these types of renderings that get shown is that rarely do the stadiums actually match them in the end. It's clearly just fan art. And it's something that is, and here's the thing, you don't even have to pay for advertising. The copy editor will put it on the front of the local newspaper just because it's nice art, and the newspaper doesn't even seem to be any wiser to the fact that they're just giving away free advertising.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's something that I wanted to stress here too. And something I think about a lot is that it's marketing is really what these things are, right? With these stories or the pictures or any of the, you know, before the thing is actually built, any of that is all marketing, but it's marketing that gets laundered for free through the media oftentimes. And that the fans eat up. I mean, to be fair, there is a large fan base in any city for any professional major sports team that is going to be, you know, sort of reflexively on board with this stuff. And the politicians are hoping to cash in on that too.
No, absolutely. And I think that we have this sort of general feeling that we tend to support the things that we like, and without supporting whether it's a good idea. And I think it's a little bit different when you think of sort of a private business decision. You might say, well, I'm not going to shop at this particular restaurant because they support a political candidate or a political cause that I disagree with. You know, and a lot of people just say, I'm not going to look at that. But this is a situation where you're having the government. You're asking other members of society to fund your personal preferences. And to me, philosophically, I think that that's wrong. But as an economist, I understand that that's really not the way we value things. And if we're going to talk about good cost-benefit analysis, certainly we're going to adopt policies and programs that I'm going to disagree with, and I'm just going to have to live with that. But I think sports stadiums are one where we can all pretty much agree there's no reasonable argument for the government being involved in this. And here's the interesting thing about this. If we stop funding all sports stadiums tomorrow, then the world would change hardly at all. Basically, just these wealthy owners would say, okay, I guess I got to fund it myself. And we know this because that's how they used to fund stadiums. Almost all stadiums that were built at the beginning of the 20th century were private stadiums. And owners would have been laughed at if they went to the local city council or county commission and asked for money to help them build a stadium. That would be like the local grocery store owner saying, hey, can you build me a new storefront? It was ridiculous. And we just sort of come to accept it. And because it's become accepted, people don't understand why. And so that's why I think you can't just say, economists say this is a bad idea. We really need to explain why it's a bad idea.
Yeah, so we should explain why it's a bad idea. And I think one of the nuts and bolts things here is that, you know, this is something else that's included in every one of those news stories about a new stadium, is there's always these promises and these projections and these economic studies that are produced that say the opposite of what you're saying, JC, that the stadium will pay for itself. Not only will it pay for itself, but it'll generate revenue for the city, and it'll create new business opportunities, and it'll, you know, look at all of the new things that will come about as a result of the stadium. Why are those studies wrong? Why should we at least be skeptical of them?
Right. Well, first off, I want to point out that most of those things that we describe as studies are not studies. They're actually just projections of an imagined future by a consultant who was hired to do exactly that. I call them economic prostitutes or economic mercenaries. These are not serious studies that are being done. But the reason why economists are, and I shouldn't say skeptical, but generally opposed to stadium subsidies, is that there doesn't seem to be any economic justification for doing so. Now, if I'm the average person and I go and I look at a sports stadium, I might say, well, look at all these people spending money on tickets, buying concessions. Maybe they're going to a restaurant before the game or going to shops nearby. Clearly, that spending that wouldn't be happening if the team is here. Clearly, they're generating an economic benefit. JC, you don't know what you're talking about. They're clearly an economic benefit. But what economists have understood for a very long time is that this really just represents a reallocation of existing local spending. That is, if people weren't spending their money going to the game or on restaurants outside the stadium, they would likely be spending it on other things within the community. That is, they'd be going out to eat, going to the bowling alley, going to a movie theater, just spending it generally on things that they like at home. And the county or city or the jurisdiction that's funding it wouldn't be any worse off. And so It's the classic case of what 19th century economist Frederick Bastiat called the seen and the unseen. We see these people spending money in and around stadiums, but what we don't see is their foregone spending. That is, they'd be spending it elsewhere in the community. And so that's where this problem occurs. And so public officials are easily fall for this fallacy because they really love the fact that, you know, they're being told this is a good idea while sitting next to the owner in the owner's box having cocktails.
Yeah, I imagine it's easy to be convinced in those situations. You mentioned Bastiat. I mean, I'm sure he would be opposed to sports stadiums if there had been ones around, or sports stadium subsidies if they had been around in the early 1800s in France. There's also like a seen and the unseen element to the way a lot of these subsidies work, because you've got, like I mentioned with the new DC project, that they're talking about $500 million, I think it is, in public money up front for the stadium. But then there's always, you know, infrastructure improvements. There's always property tax abatements. In this case, I think there's a perk in here where the Commanders are going to be paying something like $1 in rent for as long as they're in the stadium, something like that. I mean, those costs add up too. Those end up being liabilities for local governments.
Right. And what's going on here is what public finance economists call fiscal illusion. It's where you have public officials are putting forth sort of budgets or funding mechanisms in bad faith to sort of make what they like look better. It creates the illusion that it's paying for itself. And so one of the things that team owners and other proponents of stadium deals have learned is that, well, if we can make it look like it's not real tax money or get money from sources that aren't obviously tax money, we can claim that it's not tax money. And so one way to do this is to say, well, why don't we put it on public land? And that public land where the stadium is located is very valuable for doing other things. And so it doesn't come off the books as looking like it's valuable, but particularly when you're giving funding rights or development rights for 99 years, you know, you own that land, you rent it out. That's money that could have been earned by taxpayers or something else. And just because it doesn't directly come out of your property taxes doesn't mean it's not a real cost, because that's funding that could have been used to fund other things or return to taxpayers. So it's important to point out that there's no such thing as a free stadium. And that is, you can't just magically pull revenue out of the air, whether by building a stadium district to collect taxes around the stadium, or whether you're building roads that are needed to fund the stadium. That's just a different form of subsidy, or in-kind subsidies, we sometimes call it in economics. And so it's important to point out that there's nothing free here. There's always going to be an opportunity cost. And here's how we know it's true. If you could fund a stadium simply by doing all these things, you know, pulling money out of thin air, then why don't we fund everything out that? Why don't we fund schools like that? Why don't we build districts around schools and say, oh, well, all the spending around here goes to the schools? And you'd be, oh, we do that. Oh, yeah, that's right. General funding for schools, we agree it's a good idea, and that's why we tax it. But that's not why we fund stadiums.
So some of this, I mean, and a lot of this debate happened in D.C., but this is a debate that you could really apply, I think, or a dynamic that you could apply to a lot of these discussions over stadium projects. But there was a debate here between, you know, well, should they use the RFK, the old RFK site that has been kind of dilapidated for decades over there in Capitol Hill? Is that, you know, should that be rebuilt as a new stadium for the football team, for the Commanders, or should it be torn down and should housing be built there? And I think that if you could just sort of compare and contrast those two possibilities in terms of what the long-term revenue base for the city would look like, or what that would mean for other, you know, the housing stock in DC. Obviously, we need more of that to begin with anyway. But just as an example of the way there's always other uses for that land, oftentimes uses that would be more productive or would be better for the taxpayers.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes we do get caught up in trying to figure out what that alternative is. And so people say, oh, we should use it for some type of housing or some type of other type of development. And my view is that we should just sell the land. Let private entrepreneurs figure out what's the best way to spend that money, because we often don't know what is good. And so, you know, all these stadium developments were largely pitched as, well, this is going to revitalize an area that was dying. One of the things we know that doesn't revitalize areas is our stadiums. And so take a look at, you know, not far away in Washington, D.C., you can go look at Camden Yards, which was pitched as sort of the new style stadium that would revitalize the area. And anyone who's been to the stadium knows that, yeah, Camden Yards is nice. Maybe right around it, it's a slightly nicer, but there's no economic development really happening in the broader community. But I think it also extends to what else might be built. It doesn't mean that the government should build something else or try and develop something else. I think government is very bad at figuring out private investment. That's why we don't have government investing in a lot of things. So I think it's best to divest ourselves of this land. If it's not needed for a stadium anymore, put it up for auction and let someone else buy it. And I suspect, given the growth of the DC area, that it will probably be used for housing and other types of development, and let people figure out what the best way is to use that long term.
And hey, if the billionaire owner of a sports team wants to buy the land and build a stadium there, right? Like, more power to him. That's fine. You would say that's fine.
No, absolutely. And so if I mean, look, sports stadiums can be good. I mean, I understand that when you build a stadium, people come and they enjoy it. Just like any other business, whether it's a nice restaurant or, you know, an amusement park. We want private entrepreneurs to do these things, to provide things that owners want. There's really no justification for government getting involved. And so this is where I sort of fall back on my economics training and welfare economics, say, well, what is the externality here? That is, what is not being captured by private developers that would be beneficial to the community that we should just, that would justify subsidies because it wouldn't be built otherwise. And there just isn't a case for it when it comes to anything related to sports stadiums. And, or let's say the case is so weak that it's just generally a bad idea.
Well, let's play devil's advocate, or I'll play devil's advocate a little bit with that idea, because I think that the idea of externalities is obviously very important to this. And I think there's some things that, you know, proponents of these projects would accuse you of just glossing over or missing. And not just you, but economists in general. If you're too focused on the dollars and cents, you miss the, I don't know, let's call it the civic pride of having a championship team in your city. There's something intangible about that, right? Isn't that worth something to taxpayers? Shouldn't the politicians think about that?
So absolutely. I mean, it's not just about investment. Most of the spending that we do is about consumption. And so there are really sort of three ways we can measure this. One is that we can actually, we can look at, let's say, property values around stadiums. Do they go up or down? That suggests that there's some extra value outside the stadium. And the answer to that is, well, it's sort of mixed, but it looks like that most of the value of land around stadiums has nothing to do with the stadiums. It's just nice developable land where its value tends to go up. But sometimes it does go down because there's negative spillover effects associated with stadium events like crime and congestion. And no one wants to locate a grocery store right next to a stadium. So that makes it desirable for that type of economic activity. The second way we can look at it is voting on it. So we look at what happens when we have public votes. And basically, public votes tend to fail a lot. And so if you go and you ask the city council, or county commission or state legislature, they tend to approve 95% of stadium requests. But if you go to voters, you're looking at sort of a somewhere between 50 and 60% approval. So they're not always approved. And if you look at surveys of citizens, they tend to oppose public funding. And the third way we can do that is we can actually look at some sort of sophisticated economic polling. That is, how do you value that civic pride? And so people are polled on how much they would be willing to pay for a stadium. And when you look at those numbers, you know, you might get some positive benefit. And when you aggregate it up to what people are willing to spend, they tend to want to spend far less than what's actually being spent. That is tens of millions of dollars instead of hundreds of millions of dollars. So for example, you might ask me, hey, would you like to have a Ferrari? And I'd say, yeah, I'd like to have a Ferrari. I'd be willing to do that. Okay, we should do that. Well, that means you're going to have to sell your house, not go on vacation, and you're going to have to eat nothing but grits and oatmeal for the rest of your life. Well, okay, maybe I don't want a Ferrari. And that's the same way people feel about stadiums. Hey, my taxes are going to go up by this amount. Yeah, I think the old stadium is just fine.
I support the public subsidies for Eric and JC to have Ferraris plan. Let's see if we can get our local officials to approve that. You mentioned that it's generally these things, when they're put to the general public, they fail. Or when you survey the general public on how much you'd be willing to pay for a project like this, they generally fail. But city councils, politicians like them. Is that just a result of, hey, they get to go sit in the owner's luxury box? Like you said, I know there have been some cases where that's true. Like the Minneapolis City Council, I think, got like a special luxury box in the Vikings' new stadium there, some sort of a deal like that. Is that just pure cronyism, or is it that the politicians are looking at this through a different lens than the average guy on the street?
I think it's the different lens, and this is something that has come from sort of my both practical and academic study of how local economic development gets done. And there is, if you're in any city in the country, you're going to have deal with this sort of local economic development ethos, which is economic development isn't getting richer or wealthier as a community. What it is we're actively seeking out promotion of business. And so you'll have local economic development offices, chambers of commerce are always promoting all these sort of harebrained schemes to try and do things. Like, oh, we're going to generate economic development. But it creates a culture where politicians and other local leaders sort of get together and pat each other on the back and tell each other how good they are. So they sort of just naturally sort of think sports stadiums are a good idea. Now, I do often mention that, hey, you get to go stay in an owner's, you get to visit the owner's box, you get to, go to championship events, maybe ride in the World Series parade. And that does happen. I do think those are real benefits. But I think actually a lot of the benefits is just the culture you hang around, these are what your friends want. And so, you know, this is what the cool kids in the cafeteria are doing. Don't you want to be one of the cool kids in the cafeteria? And so it's kind of strange how that's how local economic development culture works. And so I think you have a lot of politicians who just say, well, I'm doing this because everyone around me says it's a good idea. We're all patting each other on the back and telling each other this is a good idea. Let's just keep doing it. So, you know, what's one of the things I point out is, yes, there are some perks like, hey, we're going to have a stadium box that's just for elected officials. But I also think it's just sort of the general admiration of your peers is something that these local politicians are after. And that's why I think it's important to sort of change the culture about this, thinking about this as saying, this really is a bad idea. And if you think it's a good idea, you need to make a compelling case for it rather than just listen to all your buddies sitting with you in the cafeteria.
You made the analogy earlier to an amusement park. And I think that's probably a really useful way to think about these things going forward is like if there was a, state program to subsidize the building of amusement parks, I think a lot more people would look at that somewhat skeptically than they would a sports stadium. But really, it's like that's sort of the same dynamic, right? You're appealing to like a small subset of the population that likes going to live sports or likes riding on roller coasters. Like, why I like roller coasters, why aren't there more amusement parks? Why aren't we subsidizing those? Well, like, so I guess my question here is, what makes the sports stadium unique among these other things? Why aren't we subsidizing the building of amusement parks? Why aren't we subsidizing the building of bowling alleys and movie theaters or whatever else?
The sad thing is actually we are subsidizing those things. And that's, actually, I often joke about that. Like we wouldn't subsidize the local Walmart. Then someone points out that, well, Walmart's getting a ton of subsidies. And I think that's a symptom of that problem that people think that we have to actively be engaging in economic development rather than just letting private investors decide what it is that the community wants. But I do think that sports is sort of a special case for that because it's easier to make the case because everyone likes it. And I think there have been situations in which significant investments have happened for other local economic development because they've been attached for sports. So right here in Atlanta, where I live, Mercedes-Benz Stadium and State Farm Arena are right next to each other, right in downtown Atlanta. And there's an area called the Gulch around it. And there's been a significant amount of development funding that's going to redevelop what's called the Gulch. And we're talking several billion dollars. Now, the interesting thing is that the person leading the project happens to be the owner of the Atlanta Hawks. And I have a theory, and there's no way to prove this, that I think he bought the Hawks because he thought it'd be easier to get some subsidies to do that because he could say, oh, this is about sports. And, you know, maybe he could have gotten it otherwise. There's no way I can prove that. But I definitely think there's this sort of idea that, well, sports are good. And look, whether you're whatever, and I don't even know how we describe political parties these days, but whatever your political persuasion is, everyone says, well, I can root for the local sports team and let's not talk politics. And so I think that's one of the reasons why stadiums or sports in general get funded so easily. And, you know, this all really happened by accident because you sort of saw these multi-purpose stadiums being built in the 1960s and 70s and even into the 80s where they was pitched as this is a local project, multiple teams can play here. And owners realized, man, these politicians will give us everything we want. Why don't we go ask for our own personal stadium with luxury boxes? They'll give it to us. And so that's really what's happened is that everyone just assumes it's a good idea and everyone goes along with it. And, you know, I get angry at owners sometimes, but they're doing what anyone would do. Why pay for something when if I apply myself, I might get it for free? I believe that's the wisdom of George Costanza on Seinfeld.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that's right. I mean, the people to blame here are the politicians that are voting yes for this, not the owners that are asking for it. You can ask for whatever you want, but the politicians should be better stewards of taxpayer money. You mentioned Atlanta and you mentioned some of the, you know, owners just asking for more and more. There is this kind of sense that there's a new wave of stadium building coming. I know you've written a bunch about this. This is largely, I assume, the point of the book that you're publishing later this year. And I want to get get to that. But I think before we get to that, you know, what's coming next on these trends, we do have to go back. You talked a little bit about this already, but I want to go back and just ask about the history of these subsidies, because this is actually something I'm not all that aware of, even though I've covered these things for quite a while. Like, when did we start doing this? Because certainly there was a point in time, you know, I don't know, maybe it was ancient Rome when they built the Colosseum or something was the first subsidy, but certainly there was a point in time in which this was not the norm. As professional sports were getting started, you know, 150, 100 years ago in this country. And then, like, where did this idea come from? Like, what was the first city that said, sure, we'll build a stadium for you?
Wow. So it's really interesting to look at the history of stadium building. And like I said, I love sports, and I particularly love sports history and love economic history. So it's great to go back and look. So you sort of think of sort of the main team sport in the U.S. going back to the beginning of the 20th century is baseball. So baseball becomes a major league in the late 1800s. And really up until the early 20th century, most stadiums were wooden stadiums that would burn down quite frequently. And so really in 1909, you have three stadiums that were built out of concrete and steel. You have Forbes Field, the Athletics that was in Pittsburgh, Philadelphia Stadium, escaping.
Connie Mack Stadium. Yeah. Tribe Park, right?
So. Shibe Park, yes, in Philadelphia. Yep. And you have the St. Louis Stadiums, what was a rebuilt Sportsman Park that were built in 1909. And all those stadiums lasted about 60 years, by the way. So they were steel and concrete. They weren't burning down. And they were new private stadiums being built throughout the country. And basically, public stadiums really didn't start getting built. You start really into the 1930s, but you have some sort of introduction in the 1920s. You look at Soldier Field, you look at the LA Coliseum. They were not built primarily to support sports teams. Like the Bears that play at Soldier Field, or if you want to call what today Soldier Field is the old Soldier Field, the Bears played most of their history at Wrigley Field in Chicago. So they actually played in a private stadium, but they came to host public stadiums. And so about the time those stadiums are wearing out, you're looking really in the 1960s, but you have some sort of stadiums that are being built in the 1950s, like the Milwaukee Braves. That Milwaukee County Stadium was built to attract a major league team. They attract the Boston Braves. They become the Milwaukee Braves in the 1950s, and that's a municipal stadium, and that is built by, and it was basically pushed by local civic leaders like the Chamber of Commerce. They say, we want to be a major league team. We're not just a Midwestern farm town anymore. We're a major metropolis. And so that was the idea behind that. The idea was they would pay rent. You know, we'd have a team here and everyone would love us. And so all these owners around the league says, well, wait a second, why can't I get my stadium built? And so owners around the country began building stadiums, and they began attracting teams from other places. So you have the Dodgers and the Giants moving out west to California. And then even cities that have teams say, well, we got to start building stadiums. Football becomes big. So really you have this peak in stadium building that happens around 1970, which these are mostly, and I'm talking mostly baseball and football, but NBA and NHL hockey are also happening around this time. And it peaks around 1970 with all these new stadiums that are largely replacing a lot of these old wooden stadiums or replacing old municipal stadiums where football teams played, and they were sharing a lot of stadiums. But then you have another peak of stadium building that happens around 2000, 30 years later. So in the 1990s, we have what economist Robert Boddy called stadium mania. You had this sort of uptick in stadium building. If you go back and look at the number of stadiums opened by years, you can see these distinct peaks that happened in 1970 and 2000. And, you know, we're approaching 2030. You start seeing, well, is there a replacement cycle here? And in fact, what we're seeing is that there is a replacement cycle. Team owners like new stadiums because new stadiums have benefit from what economists call the novelty effect. And that is people are more likely to go to new stadiums. They want to see, hey, better sight lines, find new concessions options. Plus, new stadiums are built with modern amenities that maybe didn't exist when the first stadium was built and can be incorporated into new capital construction. And that wears off after about 10 years. So then becomes the question is, well, why do they wait 30 years to ask for a new stadium? Well, almost all stadiums operate with 30-year leases. And so anytime you see a lease being up, that's when a team says, well, we got to move. Even though, you know, 30-year lease is up on your house, you don't say, well, I got to move to a new house. You're like, great, my house payment went away. I mean, that's how we tend to think about this. When it comes to sports stadiums, the owners want a new stadium. And it's often said, well, the team is going to leave even though there's no place for them to go. So that's what we get, what I call the stadium replacement cycle. And, you know, I talk about this with research with some of my colleagues, Dennis Coates and Brad Humphreys, and we've written about this. And really, Jeff Profiter, who does a lot of research, he's a public policy scholar at University of Colorado, Denver, has done some work on aggregating these leases and shows that most leases are 30-year leases, and that's why you want a replacement. And we can actually look at some key examples of this. So right here in Atlanta where I live right down the road from Truist Park, which replaced Turner Field in downtown Atlanta. Turner Field only lasted 20 years. Why did it last 20 years? Well, Turner Field was built with a 20-year lease. And so after 20 years, they abandoned it. So that's why we're seeing this sort of uptick in stadium building now, is that, you know, you mentioned the Commander Stadium. Well, they've been in that stadium for about 30 years. And so now it's time to move on to another one. And I think it's worth remembering that these new stadiums, when they open, are always considered game changers and new. And so you go back and look at the opening of RFK Stadium, which is the first of sort of those cookie cutter stadiums. And it was hailed as, you know, this is the new era of stadium building. Nothing's going to be like this ever again. It was an example of what you should be building in a stadium. And now it's considered antiquated and we got to tear it down.
So this makes me think back to the conversation we had a few minutes ago about like the externalities of these new stadiums and the positives and the negatives there. Like, I grew up going to Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia because I'm a Phillies fan when it comes to baseball. And so old Veterans Stadium was one of those, you know, concrete cookie cutter 1970s. I think it opened in 75 or 76. Not great seats, not great sight lines, really more of a football stadium than a baseball stadium. It looked the same as the ones in Pittsburgh and St. Louis and Cincinnati and a bunch of other places. Not a lot of character to it. I go now to Citizens Bank Park and it's like night and day. It's so much better. It's a so much better experience. That's, first of all, I feel like maybe I got something out of that. We talked earlier about like, okay, this is just the government subsidizing your preferences as a fan. I get that, but it's like, That was an upgraded experience for me and for lots of other people that go to those games. We've gotten something out of that. But as we look forward, then, like, okay, I think, doesn't a team like Philadelphia have a harder time, or any of these teams with stadiums that were built in the 2000s, have a harder time making the case that we need upgrades now, 30 years later? Like, there were obvious deficiencies with those 70s stadiums. It feels like there's less obvious deficiencies with a lot of the newer stadiums. And yet, I mean, your point stands, like we're still, you know, tearing down some of these new stadiums and building even newer ones. But it seems like that's a harder case to make to me.
Like everything in life, everything gets a little bit nicer. So it's not surprising that the stadiums that were built in the 1990s are nicer than the ones that were built in the 1960s. And so that's certainly going to be the case. But I think it's important to remember that it's all about perspective. And so when those stadiums opened in the 1960s, they were hailed as achievements in modern stadium building. Everyone has to have this nice new stadium, and it's going to stand for the next 50, 60 years. But, you know, you mentioned Philadelphia. I will not be surprised if both the Eagles and the Phillies come asking for handouts for either replacement stadiums or for significant upgrades. So what you have is a situation like in Baltimore or Camden Yards. So it opens in 1992 and everyone says, you know, it was sort of the first sort of new modern retro ballpark. And everyone looked at that and said, wow. And that actually kind of hurt Baltimore when the Orioles were trying to look for a new stadium, because how can we tear down this iconic stadium? So what did they do? Well, they just went to the government and said, well, we need money to revitalize it. And they got, you know, $600 million in subsidies, and the same for the Ravens Stadium, which is not far away from there. $600 million is a significant subsidy. I mean, that's way more than the team got to build Camden Yards. And so whether you're getting an upgraded stadium that's costing $600, $700 million, $1 billion, or a new stadium, that's still significant public money. So they're coming back and asking for it. That's why we're going to see this new wave of stadium building isn't just going to be new stadiums, but also it's going to be refurbishment of old stadiums. But owners really do prefer new stadiums, because just the physical infrastructure of the stadium is hard to correct, particularly if it wasn't built as nice as you wanted it to be, even though it can be. So, you know, if you want to look at two stadiums that were built around the same time, you have Nissan Stadium where the Tennessee Titans play, and you have Gillette Field where the New England Patriots play. They were both built within a few years of each other. If you look at them on Google Maps overhead, they look nearly identical. I'm sure that there are differences within their structure, but the same companies tend to build them. But look at what's happened. So the Tennessee Titans Stadium was publicly funded, and they're beginning a brand new stadium right next to the old one. Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, built his own stadium on his own. He did get some help for some infrastructure interchange right around the stadium, but we're talking like $70 million, not hundreds of millions of dollars. And He's refurbishing the stadium all by himself on his own right now. The Titans didn't do that. They were able to sort of, you know, being in Nashville, take the local legislators out to dinner and lobby them. And there's been documented lobbying that was going on for that. And so that's sort of the ethos of the area. And I do think that certain communities are less prone to funding stadiums. And so, for example, I think Boston is one of those areas. A lot of communities on the West Coast aren't willing to build stadiums for teams. So I think a lot of it is changing political attitudes, which is actually one of the reasons why I'm focused on doing that.
Yeah, I do want to ask you a bit later about some of that, about some of the pushback that's happened in a bunch of places. But before we move on too far from this sort of the trends of stadium development, we got to talk about Truist Park. You mentioned it already, the one that's right down the street from you there. You're north of Atlanta at Kennesaw State University. This is built out. It's like kind of even beyond the suburbs or at the very edge of the Atlanta suburbs as a team that moved from one of these, you know, downtown ballparks in the vein of Camden Yards or, you know, any of these kind of retro ballparks. They moved way out into the suburbs. It's a whole huge development, not just a ballpark, but hotels. And they've got a whole, you know, entertainment district and condos and all of this stuff. I've not actually been there yet, but everything I've read about it suggests that this is like the new model. It's the new Camden Yards for what every team owner is going to want in the next 30 or 40 years. So I guess you live right there. First of all, I guess, tell me, what's your impression of what the Braves have done there? And then we can get into the economics of it too, because I know this cost a lot of money. This cost Cobb County a lot of money.
Right. So just to correct something you said there, that, and I understand why you didn't get this right. Actually, the Braves stadium is actually not way out in the suburbs. It's actually on the very edge of the suburbs. It's actually on what in Atlanta we call the perimeter, which is like the outer belt. So it is you're correct to call it the suburbs, but a lot of people say, oh, well, because they're talking about building a hockey stadium that is way out. And so it is actually pretty accessible in the way Atlanta is built, that it's really spread out. But what you're exactly right on is this brand new development. It's not integrated into an urban environment. Basically, they took an area that no one was building on because there were gas pipelines underneath, this huge natural gas pipelines. And so obviously the government paid to move those pipelines so that the land became available. And what they built is sort of, you had this sort of, you got maybe 3 to 5 blocks of new building around the stadium. And you're going to have, there's some office buildings, there's 2 or 3 hotels, and there's retail shops on the ground with maybe some condos above that. And actually, I was just happened to be down there this past weekend. Had a friend in town and wanted to go down there to show it to him. And it's really kind of sort of like an outdoor shopping mall. It's not, you know, people will say it's like Wrigleyville. It's like, well, it's more like Main Street USA in Disney World, in the sense where it's mostly chain restaurants. You got a Shake Shack, you got a Yard House. It's a fine place to go around a stadium, but the idea is that, well, look, we're building not just a stadium, we're building this development where people are going to be spending their money. And so it's going to stimulate economic development. But what I've done is I've actually looked into this question. I think you raised an important point that it's actually outside the city of Atlanta. This is the jurisdiction of Cobb County gave $300 million to fund this project. And so you might say, well, people who were going to Atlanta Braves games down in Fulton County, where the Atlanta stadium used to be, are now spending in Cobb County. Shouldn't that pay for it? And I'm actually the one who's done the study that shows that actually, yes, there has been a slight uptick in spending, but it's been so small, it's not near enough to cover the $300 million price tag. And when you net out what the county is spending, it's costing Cobb taxpayers about $50 a year per household to fund the debt on the stadium and other costs related to the stadium. And so it's a net money loser, about negative $15 million a year. And even in what it's described as sort of the new paradigm for stadium building. Yet even local officials here, I look at the same numbers they look at and they go, look, this is proof it's succeeding. And what they're doing, they look at one side of the ledger and not the other side of the ledger. So the reality I think that people don't understand is that sports really aren't big business relative to the rest of the economic activity that happens in a community. So if you look at the annual report of, say, local Target store, which I've done, the amount of gross revenue that's spent at the Battery is equivalent, which is the area around the Truist Park, is equivalent to a Target store. And Cobb County has 7 Target stores, yet there's not near as much ink spilled on it. You know, people just love talking about sports. So it's actually even a very small amount of spending. And one of the things that people also don't realize is no one in Atlanta is traveling to the Battery outside of game days. They're all coming for the games. No one says, oh, I really need to go to Jenny's Ice Cream at the Battery because there are 12 other locations throughout Atlanta. No one needs to go to the Battery to go to Shake Shack. There's plenty of other Shake Shacks, and there are lots of other places to go. So, yeah, people do spend some money, but it's definitely not an engine of economic development. It absolutely has not been an economic catalyst. It is absolutely a net money loser. And then you want to get to the civic pride benefits. Well, the man who's responsible for bringing the Braves to Cobb, his name was Tim Lee. He was we have a Cobb County Commission that has a chairman. So he's sort of like our mayor of Cobb County, if you want to think about it like that. It was his idea. In his next reelection, an anti-stadium candidate ran against him on that one issue, and the chairman lost in a landslide. People didn't want to spend that money, and so it was very unpopular. And so, again, it's one of those situations where people think it's wildly popular and a success when, in fact, the opposite is true.
Yeah, and I've seen reports that like Cobb County had to cut their parks funding or something like that in response to some of the budgetary problems they had after giving the Braves all that money too. I think something you said there, though, that's interesting to me was about how, you know, nobody's coming to the Battery outside of game days, because it seems, again, from an outsider's perspective here, it seems like that whole development idea was a direct response to something stadium critics had been saying for a long time, which was the economic benefits of building a stadium downtown are limited because there's only 8 NFL games a year. There's only 81 baseball games a year. Like, okay, you spend a bunch of money on Camden Yards, sure, and maybe that makes the area right around Camden Yards a little bit nicer, but the rest of Baltimore is still, you know, not necessarily a place that a lot of people want to go. And so the Braves project seems like a response to that, in the sense of, well, okay, we'll have condos here too. We'll have a Jenny's ice cream and burger joints and all this other stuff, so that people will spend money here 365 days a year, not just when there's games. But you're saying that's not happening, or at least that isn't happening to the degree maybe that it was expected.
Right. And, you know, I think it's also interesting to go back and look at what was said about Turner Field, its predecessor, when it opened in 1997. I mean, you look at Braves officials and city officials saying, look, we're totally going to transform this area, which was, you had Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. It was a cookie cutter stadium with a big parking lot around it, so nothing could develop. By the way, the Braves actively opposed any development around the stadium because it would compete with them. But when they opened Turner Field, it was done with the Olympics in mind. They said, look, we're going to turn this into a park, and people are going to want to come down here. And no one wanted to be there because stadiums are very disruptive. And actually, the stadiums very much destroyed those neighborhoods that were there, which were largely African-American communities. The interesting thing now is that if you want to go look at the area around Truist Park, you can go, oh, okay, there's some stores here. This is nice. I urge you to go and visit the area around Turner Field, which still is standing. It's now a football stadium associated with Georgia State University, which has very few games and hardly anyone goes. It is one of the coolest areas in Atlanta now. There are lots of cool, you know, there's a cool brewery down there. There's lots of restaurants. There's a bakery. There's a grocery store. There's lots of apartments. It's much nicer than it used to be without the stadium. And it's a far nicer place to be than the Battery in Atlanta. And I'm someone who lives in the suburbs, and I love going down to the area where Turner Field used to be. It's a much nicer area. So I think if people want to look at what they can see, go look at places where stadiums have left. And this has been verified by economic studies, where they find that when teams leave areas, the area around the stadium actually tends to improve, because stadiums tend to be located in desirable areas in the first place, and they actually tend to inhibit growth rather than promote it.
I'm shocked that the politicians are getting this wrong, that their decisions are not the decisions that the market would make. Absolutely shocked by that news at 11. I want to ask you, since you're talking about, you know, go visit places where stadiums used to be but aren't anymore, let's talk about some cities that have handled this well. You already mentioned some cities on the West Coast, like Oakland comes to mind. They've been very resistant to building a new stadium for the Athletics. The Raiders left town already over the fact that they weren't getting a new stadium. You had St. Louis, you know, the Rams left after not getting a new stadium there either. It seems too simple and obvious to just say that the politician should always say no when teams come around asking. But is that actually the right thing to do? Should you just say, sorry, go take a hike? We don't care if you leave for some other city.
So absolutely. And I'll say this. So my daughter goes to college in Montreal, Canada. And so when I went up to drop her off in Montreal, my wife and I went up there, and it was like a vacation for us. I'm like, Montreal is the coolest city. We're riding around the subway doing things. I actually went to go visit the old Olympic Stadium where the Expos used to play, and there's almost nothing going on around it, which, by the way, they're rehabbing the stadium for some reason, even though no team plays there and there's hardly any development around it. But my point is that Montreal didn't all of a sudden become a terrible city to go to. How about San Diego, which lost the Chargers? I mean, San Diego is one of my absolute favorite cities of all time, whether they have a football team or not. I mean, you can't beat the weather. It's a fun place to walk around. And yeah, they have some sports there. You can go the San Diego Padres, Petco Park is one of my favorite ballparks. And there's an area around it is quite nice. That's because the area around it was quite nice before the stadium was built, and the area closest around the stadium isn't that great. So I think that politicians need to understand that they actually have more leverage than they think they have. There aren't. So when you think about the movement of stadium franchises that happened sort of in the middle of the 20th century, particularly out to the West Coast, you had sort of a demographic shift. You had a lot of population centers that weren't served by sports teams. Now, if you look across the U.S., almost every major city has a local sports team. A major league sports team, that is, cities that are certainly over a million and five have, whether it's, if you want to throw MLS into that, there are a lot fewer teams. So a lot fewer vacant markets to move to. And so if you say, I want to go move to another city, you're already a big city. Fine, go ahead and go. And the owner doesn't want to leave. The owner wants to be there. And so NFL owners learned the hard way when they left Los Angeles. And by the way, the NFL fought very hard to keep the NFL from leaving. They sort of had a rogue owner. And after a while, 20 years not having a team, the owner of the Rams just said, I'm losing too much money by playing in St. Louis. I'm going to go build my own stadium, and I'll use the San Diego Chargers as a tenant. We'll put two teams back there. And Los Angeles is better off, and it's being funded largely by a private owner. And San Diego is just fine, and Chargers fans can watch the game on TV if they want to follow the NFL, just like most people do across the country.
Let's expand this out here, last few minutes away from just stadium subsidies, to talk about some of these big sports events, many of which are happening in this country and happening in the next few months. We've got the Super Bowl obviously coming up just here in the next couple of weeks. Every year the NFL talks up the Super Bowl to whatever host city has it. This year it's in Santa Clara, California. They talk it up as this like huge economic driver that's going to bring in all this money. It's like the NFL is coming to town and just showering you with buckets of cash. What do the economics actually say about that?
Well, the economics are largely the same, in that it's the economics of the seen and the unseen. You see all these people coming to town, staying in hotels, spending money in nice restaurants. Look at all this added money. But what you don't see is that most of these cities that host the Super Bowl have hotels that are full during that time of year anyway. So when the Super Bowl is held in Florida, who's traveling to Florida in January and February? Well, a lot of people. And so when you have the Super Bowl, it's just people displacing people in existing rooms. And so when economists have actually gone in and looked at how much added new commerce you see when you host an event like the Super Bowl, it's positive, but it's not very large. So you see these economic studies, and they're totally phony studies. They'll say it's generating $800 million in economic benefits. You know, it's like, if you say it's $8 million, I might buy it, but not $800 million. It's absolutely ridiculous. But it's expanded so far that now everyone mentions any event, whether it's a youth softball tournament. So the funniest one, I think, is the NFL draft. And they talk about, you know, it's generating hundreds of millions of dollars of economic benefit for some bros to come and sit in a room and watch some names being called. Kansas City canceled 2 days of school to host the NFL draft. Everyone on that school board who voted for that should be recalled from office for being totally incompetent. Can you imagine that? The damage that did to that community? So we're making stupid decisions about something that economists have studied to death. There are not even, it's not one of those cases where like, well, there's some mixed studies on this. No, it's universally, these are a terrible idea. You're not going to get rich off of it. Yeah, it's nice to host a Super Bowl. And if the NFL wants to put its game there, let them do it. But there's no reason for taxpayers to be footing the bill for it at all.
Let's talk about the Olympics, too. Obviously, the Winter Olympics are coming up in Italy in February. And then we've got the Summer Olympics in L.A. in 2028. The price tag for hosting the Olympics has honestly just gotten astronomical in the last few cycles. We're talking, you know, billions of dollars, well over that. But it seems like maybe that trend is now reversing. It's like there was almost nobody who wanted to bid for a couple of Olympic Games a few cycles ago. And the IOC's made some changes now to how that's going to work. Do you think the price tag for that is coming down? Of the Olympics becoming less of a bad deal for countries to host?
I mean, it's just hard to know, because there's so much graft and corruption going on, that what actual numbers are we looking at? I do think that the fact that there weren't a lot of bidders, particularly in the U.S., because everyone realized you're building all these arenas that really are used for at 3 weeks at the most. And then there's really no use to have for some of these things. So one of the reasons why LA was attractive, because it's such a big city, they already have a lot of venues for it. But I think, you know, it just over time, people started seeing, hey, we had them in Greece and look at all the empty arenas. You know, the Bird's Nest in China was a very iconic venue. It's used for nothing now. And so, you know, I think that people are understanding, why are we spending time doing this? Plus, if you've ever lived in a city where they've hosted the Olympics, and so, you know, I wasn't living in Atlanta at the time, but I have tons of family here. And so I spent some time in Atlanta. And let me tell you, no one wants the Olympics back in Atlanta anytime soon. It was quite disruptive. And so I think that's part of it as well. And so, you know, I'd love to see communities catch on more about funding local sports teams, because they're not as obviously disruptive as the Olympics are. But it's something I think that people are catching on to. And hopefully the price tag is going to go down. But the problem is that, you know, there's so much prestige involved with organizing these events that local politicians that get elected really get talked into these things all over the place. So I wish I could be optimistic that this is getting better, but reality tells me that nope, they're just going to find a new way to ram these things through.
Yeah. LA in 1984, I think, is the only Olympics, right, that was done without public money, or was the only Olympics that made a profit, something like that. They've talked a lot about that in the lead up to 2028 too. Like you already mentioned, using existing venues. We've got a privately funded stadium there that I think is going to host the swimming events in the football field, which sounds really cool. But there just aren't a lot of cities like LA that can do that. Like other cities are going to end up on the hook for this in different ways.
Maybe, or maybe you could just continually have it in LA. And I do think that there's an important point to be made that there is some private money to build these things. And so I was talking about Turner Field earlier in Atlanta when we hosted the Olympics. That was the Centennial Olympic Stadium that was converted to a baseball field. That was built entirely with private money. Interestingly enough, hardly any of it, the Atlanta Braves. It was mostly Olympic sponsors who built that. So you actually can fund these things privately, and you don't need the government to do it in even building new venues. So that model can work, and it has worked.
J.C. Bradbury, thank you so much for talking to us. Just a couple things here before we get you out. I'd love to just know how you got into doing this. This is one of my favorite things to ask people, because like I'm sure, 15-year-old J.C. who was following the Carolina Panthers or whoever you were into at the time wasn't thinking about being a sports stadium economist someday. Like, how did you end up doing this? What was the thing that turned you on to this idea?
Well, by the way, when I was 15 years old, the Carolina Panthers didn't exist, unfortunately.
They didn't exist. I realized that as I was asking.
I'm an economist who studies public finance, and I wasn't really planning to study. I haven't studied the economics of stadiums for much of my career. But when I became an economist, I was writing about public finance issues. No one seemed to pay attention to any studies I was doing on state and local public finance. But when I wrote a study about baseball, you know, national publications kept calling. I said, maybe the market's sending me a signal. I can be maybe I should write about sports. Maybe that's a better thing. So that's why I got doing that. And because, and really, I will say this, that one of the reasons I write about the economics of sports stadium is totally geography. I just happen to be from, my family's from Atlanta. I live in Atlanta, and we've had a lot of stadiums being built here. So I've been involved in a lot of these debates, and I've had to become informed about it. And so since I have this knowledge, I try and share it with other people. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, what's your angle? What's your agenda? It's like, well, I'm just trying to share knowledge. I'm certainly not getting rich off it. And it certainly makes following sports actually less fun for me. But hey, you know, someone's got to do it. So I'll take one for the team.
An economist that follows market signals. We love that. Is there like a team that you automatically root against now because their stadium deal was so bad or something like that? Like, how does this color your fandom when you're watching sports?
You know, you have to put that aside. And I think that, you know, I love all types of sports. And, you know, it's funny when sports economists get together at conferences, we often go to games. And you know, it's fun. We're all sports fans. And so you just have to sort of just compartmentalize that, because, I mean, you have to root against every single team. So, you know, it's not like, well, I'm going to cheer for the Cubs or the Red Sox because they play in their own stadiums. You know, I love and hate some of those teams just like anyone else. Fandom, you have to just sort of compartmentalize it. Fandom is different than how you are. I mean, I still root for the Atlanta Braves, despite the fact that the entire front office hates my guts. I mean, that's different. I own that. They don't own that. So that's how I think about it.
Yeah, we can compartmentalize that. And that's exactly what politicians should do, too, is compartmentalize the, you can root for the team. Doesn't necessarily mean you got to spend taxpayer money on their stadium. I'm a Phillies fan. You're a Braves fan. We can compartmentalize that. And we don't have to talk about the way those two playoff series went recently here. I do want to note, though, that and maybe there's something to this. Maybe there isn't. The four teams that are left. And again, we're recording this before the championship games. But the four teams that are left in the NFL this year, you've got the Patriots. You mentioned Robert Kraft. Privately owned stadium for the Patriots, the Rams, who have a privately built stadium in LA, the Broncos, that was a publicly funded stadium, but their new owners, as I understand it, are talking about, or at least promising, that they're going to build a privately funded stadium, a new one for the Broncos in Denver. And then the Seahawks, which they did get some money, but just a very small amount of money for Lumen Field relative to the most of the other teams in the league. These are four of the model franchises in the NFL. Is there a correlation here, or is this, or is there a causation here, or just correlation between, teams that have not blown a ton of public money on their stadiums that are all having quite a bit of success?
Now, I think it's largely just random, and it's going to the Denver situation. They're calling it privately funded, but they're definitely seeking public funding. And so that's another thing. The media doesn't do a very good job of covering these things because they don't understand the economics of the deal. And so they'll call it private money, but it looks to me like, just from talking to journalists there, that they're ramping up for huge amounts of public money. Empower Field got a ton of public money. So, I'm just going to enjoy it. And, I'll make some chili to watch the Super Bowl. And that's about the extent of my enjoyment. And by the way, I love watching football. I'm a good neutral fan. So it'll be fun to watch. I've enjoyed the playoffs so far.
JC Bradbury, thank you so much for talking to us. Where can people find your work?
Yeah, so I'm very active on Twitter at JC_Bradbury, as well as on Blue Sky at JC Bradbury. And my website, jcbradbury.com, I got links to where you can find my book, my other writings, my academic writings. So just remember my name, jcbradbury.com, and you should be able to find me. And happy to engage with anyone who wants to debate in good faith, as always.
Yeah, he's fantastic on Twitter, folks. If you're not following him already, which you certainly should be, then definitely check him out there. The book, This Time It'll Be Different, will be out in July. Looking forward to that. JC, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks, Eric. Enjoyed it. Good talking with you.